Into sports.
20 yards out, Urs to shoot. Don't shoot! Oh, what a goal for Fabinho! Wow!
Then get into the all-new OTB Sports app.
I think when he apologises to me, I probably will say hello to him, yeah.
No. Videos, sports news, live scores, interviews.
If Fabregas is going to come up to me in the street and give me some of the mouth that he would have given me on a football pitch, what would he do? He'd get a slap.
Plus, exclusive content on the OTB Podcast Network. The biggest names in sports, ready when you are. Search OTB Sports on your App Store and download it now.
The OTB Podcast Network.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power. Fake crowd noise. The Emirates never sounded so good. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
All right, it's Thursday night's football show. Nathan with you for the next hour. The second half's just getting underway in the Europa League quarterfinal second leg, and Manchester United and Arsenal both well on their way to the semi-finals. Arsenal had a brilliant six-minute spell where they scored three goals. Nicolas Pepe, Alexandre Lacazette from the penalty spot, and Bukayo Saka, who's been outstanding in the first half of their game away against Slavia Prague. Emil Smith-Rowe also had a goal disallowed, so Arsenal leading by 4-1 on aggregate. And Manchester United 1-0 up on the night against Granada. Edinson Cavani with the goal in 6 minutes, 3-0 up on aggregate. Villarreal also heading to the semi-finals. They're 2-0 up against Dinamo Zagreb in their match. So on aggregate, Villarreal now leading by 3-0. The one match really that's in the balance is between Roma and Ajax. It's 0-0 on the night, but Roma leading Ajax by 2-1 on aggregate. So we'll keep an eye on them over the next hour. In a while, we will talk with Kenny Shields. He is the manager of the Northern Ireland women's team, who this week caused a major surprise by qualifying for the European Championship finals for the first time. So we'll check in with Kenny in around about half an hour's time. But Miguel Delaney is on the line. Evening, Miguel.
Evening.
You're on Roma Ajax duty like the rest of us. It's the only one that really matters right now.
Basically, yeah. I mean, I got fed up with the other two games. Well, I'm fed up, but just there's nothing on the line. And there's nothing worse than watching sterile football in that way. So I've gone with Roma Ajax. Can I have it half on in the background, basically?
Mikel Arteta will be telling the video analysts, give me that six-minute spell. Give me that six-minute spell. It's going to be in the highlights package of what we can do. But we rarely have ever seen that from Arsenal this season. The inconsistency, the change of manager hasn't ended that. Where are Arsenal? Is an eighth-place finish and a Europa League final a good season for Arsenal?
I mean, they feel like... This is the strange thing with Arsenal. They've actually had some really good performances this season, particularly in big games. So it feels like they should be better than eighth place, and they are better. But then it's been undercut by some, you know, dreadful performance. Not out of nowhere, but like one seems to come along every few games. Now, I suppose there is a little bit more of an excuse in the last few weeks because it's become pretty clear that they're prioritising Europe. This is like, I mean, I think it's why tonight was actually relatively impressive, because they pretty much staked the season on it. And they there was a real sense, there was a bit of gloom after the first leg, as if they might have blown a chance. Slavia hadn't even been that good in the first leg, having knocked out Leicester and looked good earlier in the competition. And yet Arsenal kind of went down to that almost inexplicable and needless equaliser late on. So there was a little bit of pressure on this, especially given it's their route back into the Champions League. So I think it was a big performance in that regard. And I suppose bodes well, while also keeping their season alive. I mean, a bit like the FA Cup last year, whatever happens in the Europa League will dictate how the campaign is perceived. And it could make the league campaign irrelevant. If they get into the Champions League with another trophy, then all will look good and it will be another landmark for progress.
Ajax have got a goal and it looks as though it's going to count. Brian Broby has just come off the bench and pretty much with his first touch has broken through to score. So Ajax 1-0 up on the night. It's 2-2 on aggregate. Roma, as it stands though, will go through and away goals, which is why Ajax are running into the net to pick up the ball and get restarted as quickly as they can. The Arsenal side tonight, and that exciting play again, came from the three behind Lacazette, Smith-Rowe, Saka and Nicola Pepe, who has shown signs finally maybe of delivering on, well, I guess the amount of money that Arsenal spend on him. But Smith-Rowe and Saka, both of them look like real talents that Mikel Arteta can start to build a side around over the next few years.
Yeah, totally. And as you say, there's a bit of potential in Pepe. I suppose we should be maybe a little bit... careful around this, because obviously Aubameyang has confirmed that he's suffering from malaria. But it's still, the performance again tonight emphasises that we're getting to the point where it feels they don't really need him given the attacking talent they've got. And that might be developing into another Mesut Ozil situation. I mean, obviously, the personalities are different, the context is different, but more so in the sense that they've given a huge contract to a player, you know, in the final stage, or not quite the final stage of his career. It's not like he's going to retirement yet, but a player without much sell-on value, who he was basically in for his last big contract in that way. And now, as with Ozil, they might need him, might be in a situation where they don't have to play him that often. And at a club where one of the issues has been finances have been stretched. But I suppose that's the negative. The positive is that they've got this core of young players who really enliven the team. Now, I suppose you would say one of the issues with Arsenal, and maybe one of the reasons has been this inconsistency and they're a little bit unreliable, is because there's too much responsibility on the young players. And there's basically, I mean, there are so many famous teams through history that have been built on youth. I mean, the most memorable in recent times, or sorry, in the modern era, should I say, where Ajax 1995, so that's what, 26 years ago, not that recent, and Manchester United around that same spell. But even those sides, right, it was the young players that kind of that became famous for, but they were balanced by some real senior pros. Like at Ajax, there was like Frank Rijkaard and Danny Blind. You can't really get more senior. And Manchester United, for all the concentration on youth, you know, which is why there was always a little bit of this folly to Alan Hansen's famous statement. On the other side, they had Peter Schmeichel, Steve Bruce, Gary Pallister, Eric Cantona, and Roy Keane, who in a football sense was probably never young. Whereas Arsenal, bar David Luiz, who kind of, I suppose, brings his own debate and baggage, they don't really have too many players of that ilk, and it puts more responsibility on these young players. And like, there's no one really there that feels to set that standard. And it's why maybe they need, maybe to balance out some of this, maybe they do need some kind of, some camera. I mean, to go way back, it almost sounds like they need a Dave McKay at Derby County in the 70s. But, you know, I'm not sure how, a bit like some of Martin O'Neill's stories about Nottingham Forest back when he was Irish manager towards the end. Not sure how relevant even that is towards the modern day anymore.
Yeah, who is the modern day Dave McKay? It's a question I'll ask John Giles next week, who maybe might be able to give us a perfect example. I was talking to Kenny Cunningham. We were doing commentary on Arsenal a few weeks ago and about, you know, what they can do to improve. And he was saying, obviously, still a very soft Shelley Fields at the back. The Xhaka, while there's unbelievable talent there, it still feels as though there's no consistency at all. If they are to go and build around this group of young players, financially, where are Arsenal? Are they a well-run club now? By the sounds of the contract they gave to Aubameyang, it doesn't sound it, and some of the other moves behind the scenes since Arsene Wenger left. Are they a club that you look at behind the scenes and think, yes, they have everything in place to go and do good business in the transfer market, or is it just so hit and miss?
No, I think basically they're still adapting to the post-Wenger era, and that can be indicated by the fact that that contract was offered to Aubameyang, and since then the structure has changed. Obviously, the big one is Raul Sanehi's gone. They've streamlined it. It feels like Arteta in that time, I'm going to have to check the technicalities of this. I don't think he's been promoted, or maybe actually I think he has been promoted from head coach to manager. And it feels like that's the case, is that his own responsibilities have gone up and he's got more authority with Edu above him. So, that's still like the hierarchy of the club has still been in a state of flux. Obviously, then there's been this wider issue which feeds into this, I suppose, ongoing debate from last night about ownership of the top clubs, where, you know, Arsenal have actually have, you know, some of the wealthiest people in the world owning the club in terms of the Kroenkes and his wife. But it's not exactly like there's much investment. And, you know, from that perspective, almost like a bit like a lower grade Manchester United than the Glazers, because the turnover isn't as high. They're just kind of financially stretched when a club of that size, it sometimes feels that they don't really need to be. So I think these are all issues they're still figuring out. And it's why, even though results have been bad during periods of Arteta's time, and even though, say, that November-December spell was particularly awful, there's never been any sense of pressure on him, because they know he's overtaking a difficult situation where the club is undergoing transformation. And they feel he has the personality to oversee it and the talent to oversee it. And there are probably more ructions to come as they try and get back to what they should be.
Those young English players that are coming through, like, it's such an exciting time for English football, where there's players emerging at almost all the big clubs, the top six, all have a group of players starting to come through pretty much. And even then, when you look to Germany, you look last night and you see Jude Bellingham, what Jadon Sancho has done, even Jamal Musiala, who I know has decided he's going to play with Germany. Those three players in particular and the decision to go to Germany, have they just been very well advised that actually as a career prospect, moving to the Bundesliga, you'll get opportunities at a young age? Is there a reason why suddenly this crop ended up playing in the Bundesliga?
I mean, that there was a little bit, I mean, it was set, I suppose, by Jadon Sancho, but I did a piece in this 2 years ago now about, it was very much, a talking point among young players and among youth football that the quickest way for talented young players to get immediate football at 17, 18 was to go to Germany because it was a league that was so open to youth, especially clubs like Borussia Dortmund. I remember talking to the parents of a few kids who were making that decision precisely because they felt there were more roadblocks at Premier League clubs. Now, I suppose the flip side of that is Phil Foden. I mean, I think this is a little bit of a curious situation because now it's said a lot that Pep Guardiola got his nurturing completely right. All those people complaining that he wasn't getting games, look, you know, they've made look silly. But I think it's more just a case that Foden's a special case and everyone will come through differently because it's a completely fair question. It's one of the reasons so many players have gone to Germany. There are even stats UEFA have put out on this, and it's a model Leipzig go by, or the Red Bull Empire, that basically footballers, talented footballers between the age of 17 and 19, they need senior football between those years. It's the only way to hone their talent. And if they don't get it by the age of 20 and over it, there is a real danger that waits on them because ultimately they haven't been sharpened that competitive environment. By the same token, there's a similar stat that UEFA have where I think a hugely high percentage of players that have played in the Champions League have a certain number of minutes between the ages of 17 and 19. And that's not what Foden was getting. Mm. The counter-argument is, I suppose, that ultimately every individual will develop differently. He is a special case, and City and Guardiola felt it would be better to keep him there, not send him on loan. And they've been vindicated there. But I think the wider argument is still true. And, you know, it's been a good thing for players to go to Germany in that way. But it also has to be said, I mean, as you raise it at the top there, England is basically, and this might be a rough reality for a lot of Irish people to get used to if we go by old rivalries and history and all the rest of it, but England has basically gone through the youth transformation that, say, Spain did around 2005, 2006, that Germany did around the turn of the millennium, and that France did in the mid-90s. I don't think it's a coincidence that the wealthiest football European football nations have done this. They've essentially industrialised youth production all by borrowing off each other, or borrowing ideas off each other. And England are now reaping the benefits of that, arguably more than anyone else in Europe, bar the French. And, we probably have to get used to England finishing in the latter stages of a lot of tournaments and probably winning one or two over the next few years.
And has that all come from the wealth of the Premier League clubs, or is that driven by the FA?
It's a bit of both. I mean, the FA did start to make concrete change about a decade ago. There's been a huge shift in coaching education in the country, but equally, they've benefited from what are some of the best academies in Europe or the world in that sense. I mean, a lot has been made about kind of how Chelsea hadn't brought young players through for so long, but it was just a conveyor belt of talent. Again, the issue is probably just that players at a certain age weren't getting their right about football, but it, just by sheer force of numbers, it was always something they're going to fix. And so many of those academies are of such high quality.
Because it's the style of footballer that they're bringing through as well. Before the match last night on BT, Michael Owen and Steve McManaman were talking about Real Madrid going up against Liverpool, and once upon a time Real Madrid would have hated this type of game because of the physicality and the energy that the English teams would play, and they just wouldn't be able to cope with it for 90 minutes, and they hated that type of fixture. Whereas now, there's still a bit of energy to Liverpool, but there's an awful lot of creativity and technical ability for the players that they play not that dissimilar a style of football in the two leagues. And the players that are coming through for England now, you look at the quality of Phil Foden, how comfortable he is on the ball, Jack Grealish, James Maddison, the debates they're having over sort of old school number 10s in a way, who want to get on the ball all the time. And while we feel there's a decent generation of Irish players coming through, it does feel, even watching the likes of Jason Knight and Jason Malumbi, that it's still a bit Irish in that there's a lot of energy there. They're getting up and around the pitch. They'll cover every blade of grass. But are they? Are we actually even? Are we producing the right type of player that's ever going to be able to make it in the Premier League? I guess everything we see so far suggests we're not.
Well, I suppose there's an issue in numbers there. Ultimately, I mean, like they're incomparable in terms of kind of population. Mm. And just again, by definition, England are just going to no matter what the coaching level is. Say if both were equal, and like if both were equal, England would still, you know, produce just much more players because there's so many more people. Now, I suppose there are ongoing questions about our own structure, and changes have been made, but it's been at a glacial pace because of all sorts of issues from kind of, you know, the inhibitions of age-old structures in the country, and then obviously everything that's gone on with the FAI and the lack of the lack of resources to finance some badly needed changes. But even I think, you know, we are behind England in that way. But one of the interesting things with England there is actually, and one of the reasons why German clubs have specifically looked to England as well, is because there was a period there where Germany basically probably followed the Spanish model more than anyone else. And it meant that there was about two or three generations in a row, having spoken to kind of people who work in youth coaching, where they were mostly producing these kind of almost universal midfielders. I mean, David Alaba is Austrian, but he's almost a classic of this. Now, he's a player with good mobility, and he's powerful himself. But it was still kind of this universal midfielder, almost a player that can play in several positions. But what they were producing was basically wide players who could take the ball on, beat people, and inject a bit of electricity to games. Whereas that's something that England is now producing in absolute abundance. And even players who are, sort of, I suppose, closer towards the number 10 position, like Mount, like Madison, like Grealish, they still have a large element of this from England, which is basically, it's basically a number of really fluid forwards who can play almost anywhere across the front line, but are probably best coming from wide. You know, and everyone from Callum Hudson-Odoi to Sancho to Foden are examples of this.
We didn't maybe have the drama in the Champions League quarterfinals this year that we've had of previous years. There were different types of games. There were a bit closer, not the gold rushes that we've seen in other years, but even still watching Bayern Munich against Paris Saint-Germain and the grit, and watching Neymar's performance, and listen, he could have scored a hat-trick easily in that game. The quality of football is still as good as ever in the Champions League. There is nothing better in world football than the knockout stages of the Champions League.
Oh, I'd say it's better than ever. And I don't think it's an exaggeration at this point to say it's the highest level of football we've ever seen. And that's because of what club football has become, which is basically, I mean, there are a lot of inherent problems for this and a lot for the game to consider. But, you know, a group of 8-9 clubs or so have accumulated more resources and therefore more talent, both in terms of players and coaches, than has ever been seen in football. So naturally that brings, you know, it's a collection of brilliance together. Hence we're seeing football reaching a higher level than ever before. But I suppose this game was actually a little bit of a throwback because it was so tense, and so it was low scoring in the right way, in that it didn't feel a negative game, but we're going for it. But the goals didn't come, which meant that it always had that feel where the next moment was going to be absolutely decisive, in a way that used to be the case in kind of classic European ties of the 90s, which probably were a bit more defensive because the football in the 90s was more cautious. Tactics weren't as open. You know, we didn't see the same level of pressing that we do now. But yeah, it was an absolutely brilliant tie.
So Paris Saint-Germain against Manchester City, Real Madrid against Chelsea, all the beautiful clubs finding themselves in the last four. It's hard to pick a favourite. I presume Manchester City with the bookies are going to be the favourites.
Yeah, I mean, they feel like the best. They felt like the best team in Europe for a few months. Mm. But obviously, I mean, one of the great things about the Champions League is, even though it's, you know, the most prestigious tournament in club football and supposed to crown the best team in Europe, it rarely does. I mean, when almost every time Real Madrid won it over the last few years, they probably weren't the best team. They were, in fact, I think there was only one occasion where they're the best team in Spain during that. And as Guardiola knows all too well, you can have a season of excellence that can be undone by one game or even one moment. And I do think their match with Paris Saint-Germain is 50-50. And I have to say, I fancy Chelsea for some time. I remember first thinking it, not just because Tuchel came in to replace Lampard, even though that, I think, like, it was obviously beneficial for Chelsea to get a top coach as opposed to an average to good coach in charge of what is a really good squad. But also because it felt like, at that point, they were out of title race. We're probably going to, I mean, they were quite low on the table, but there was always the feeling that was going to fix itself and they'd end up qualifying for the top four relatively easily, and I think they will do that. But also because of the depth of that squad, I think there was a point in March where all of Chelsea's most used players, so by extension then, their best and most important players, they played something like 1,000 minutes less than their counterparts at say, Manchester City, at United, at Liverpool. And that's 10 or 11 games in the most congested schedule we've ever seen in football. That's going to have a huge effect. And I think that's particularly important when it comes to the latter stages in the Champions League, when ultimately it comes down to freshness and who's fit. So allied to that, someone who is as brilliant a coach as Tuchel, and before maybe the idiosyncrasies of Tuchel's personality start to have a more, I don't want to say negative effect, but maybe cause some friction and cause issues as we see in other clubs, that it's almost like they could be in a sweet spot for the Champions League this season, maybe just barring that goal scorer.
What's your best estimate then on Tuchel's idiosyncrasies coming to the fore? Is it pre-Christmas?
Maybe towards the end of next season. It'd be interesting to see how. I think it could be a good title race between them and City next year. I mean, he's an exceptional coach, Tuchel. I suppose it helps that Chelsea have a lot of young players. He's one of those coaches. This happens with a lot of these, I don't want to say dogmatic coaches, but these highly ideological coaches, with Van Gaal being the most obvious example, and even with Pochettino to agree, in that young players respond to them better, obviously, because they're more malleable. They haven't had the experience of other clubs where they can go, well, we didn't do that there, so we're not going to do it here. There's basically less resistance with young players. And he's got a lot of Chelsea. So, you know, it could bode pretty well. And I think they'll be strong for the title race next season.
Just before we finish up, Miguel, this story that's been reported in the UK over the last few days around the Newcastle takeover, which people remember the Saudi Arabian royal family were interested in taking over Newcastle, a £300 million bid, but the Premier League kiboshed it. The Saudi Crown Prince contacted Boris Johnson around the Newcastle takeover, saying that UK-Saudi Arabian relations will be damaged if the British government failed to intervene to correct the Premier League's wrong decision not to allow a £300 million takeover. Johnson asked Edward Lister, his special envoy for the Gulf, to take up the issue, and Lord Lister reportedly told the Prime Minister, I'm on the case, I will investigate. Does this mean the takeover is possibly back on, or does it just show how far Saudi Arabia were willing to go to get the deal done?
Well, I think it's very much up in the air. My instinct would still be, or my gut, that the takeover won't happen. And also there's questions, I suppose, now about whether they can put the same deal together. But of course, all of this is basically, it underlines why it absolutely shouldn't happen. One of the arguments, it was an absolutely ludicrous, farcical argument that always stretched credulity. But it was always PIF, the Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia, that would have owned 80% of Newcastle. One of the points put forward was that they were some way separate to the Saudi state, which is absolutely, it's ridiculous. And this indicates why, especially when, Saudi Arabia is an absolute royalty where nothing goes without the say-so of the hierarchy. And you couldn't have a clearer example of that than this story where the Crown Prince himself lobbies the UK Prime Minister.
How strong of a position would the Premier League be in general in their conversations with the British government if pressure is applied? Are they, considering the success of the league, well able to stand up for themselves?
Yeah, that's what, and previously, there are all sorts of stories about how, particularly, when it was the Blair or Brown government and when Scudamore was in charge of the Premier League, they used to bring the Premier League to, economic expositions abroad, basically to show the success of UK business, or as an example of successful UK businesses. And I suppose in that sense, almost the Premier League was an element of sports washing in its own right, in that they were used to make the UK look good. It does have considerable clout in that regard, and I suppose as that could be seen. The situation probably fell favourably for the Premier League the last time, because ultimately it was that deal collapsed already on the other side, which was the actual buyers, because the amount of time it was taken, the various issues that came, and they ultimately didn't answer the Premier League's questions. So it prevented the Premier League really making a hard-line decision in that way, which was probably diplomatically favourable, but given that was there were so many complications and elements to that takeover, and chief among them, although I mean, it's telling about where club football is these days, where the major fall down was basically the issue of pirating one of the Premier League's, or pirating BT Sports, one of the Premier League's broadcast partners, rather than the fact that a state with arguably the most questionable human rights record in the world was going to try and buy, you know, a social institution, a club that means so much to its community, and try and use it for sports washing purposes, which of course should have been the immediate reason that this was a non-starter. But that's where club football is, as is going to be illustrated in the Champions League semi-finals with this grand meeting of two Gulf blockade rivals in Abu Dhabi's Manchester City and Qatar's Paris Saint-Germain.
Yeah, and we'll all be watching. Miguel, thanks as always.
Cheers. Thanks, Nathan.
Football and Off the Balls with thanks to Paddy Power. For information on responsible gambling, visit gamblingcare.ie. Two live games on Off the Ball this coming Sunday at 1:30. It's Arsenal against Fulham. Stephen Doyle and Brian Kerr will be on that one. And then we'll bring you Manchester United against Burnley from 4:00. Both Manchester United and Arsenal well on their way to the semi-finals of the Europa League.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power. Fake crowd noise? The Emirates never sounded so good. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
So, Tuesday night was a historic night for Northern Ireland football as they qualified for a major championship for the first time. A 2-0 win over Ukraine gave them a 4-1 victory on aggregate. To put that into context, Northern Ireland disbanded their women's team at the turn of the century, only got back together in 2004, and it means they're going to be at next year's European Championship finals in England. I'm joined on the line by the Northern Ireland manager, Kenny Shields. Evening, Kenny.
Evening, how are you?
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
You've had a long old managerial career, what, stretching 30 years at this stage? I'd say Tuesday night was one of the best nights.
Yeah, it was really up there. It was a fantastic achievement by the girls, and I think they give every ounce of energy that they had. They couldn't have done any more or given any more. An absolute credit to their country.
It has been put up there as an enormous shock and surprise because of Northern Ireland's ranking, because of the players that you have available, most of them part-time footballers. Were you surprised?
Yeah, I was surprised not how well we did, but how much we were able to control both games, especially Ukraine being so much ahead of us. But we took control of it. I thought tactically over the two games we were very good in terms of looking at ways in which we could beat them, because, you know, they've got what we would call better players than us. But I think we were the better team in both games.
You must be delighted then, from a tactical point of view, as to how it worked out. How difficult is it, particularly in these COVID times, when you're going up against a team like Ukraine, to get across what you want tactically, where I'd imagine there's probably limited time, face-to-face time with the players. Camps are very different from what you would have imagined as an international coach it would be, where you try and build a bond, you try and build an atmosphere. That, from everything we hear from all international camps, is quite difficult. So to get your message across for the players and for them to be able to implement it must give you enormous satisfaction.
It gives me great satisfaction because you see girls, you see the players being so happy at what they do, and you feel as if you've made a contribution to that. And that's where I get a lot of my satisfaction from. And, you know, it is football after all, and you have to be detailed in how you present your style of play and how you want to play. And, you know, I spoke with Vera, the Republic of Ireland manager. I spoke with her video analyst, Andy, and they were supportive. They tried to help me as much as they could, and I was very grateful for that.
There's obviously, when the Republic of Ireland players, I'm sure, were watching on Tuesday night, a lot of frustration from their point of view, because there was a sense against Ukraine in particular that they had left it behind. What was it that Vera, what pointers was she able to give you? Because that was a game, I guess, that Ireland felt they should have won.
Yeah. Well, she gave me some pointers, but she put me, I thought it was best to do it from video analysis to video analysis, because they work in that department, and my video analysis has done a great job, and we were very looking at the thin margins and trying to make sure that we give the girls as much information as we possibly could. And we went into really, really deep details. And because we had so many domestic players just training with us, they knew exactly what we had to do and which way we had to do it in too.
Talk about the level then the players are at. I know you a lot of injuries in there as well. There were a lot of issues around the game, and somebody like Rachel Furness, who'd be one of the more experienced players, that you didn't have everybody available all of the time. Those domestic players, in terms of the level they're at compared to the Ukrainian players, compared to what they're going to go up against in a year's time at the Euros finals, is the local domestic level maybe at a higher level than you expected?
Yes. I thought our domestic level was, they're doing a great job in bringing the players through for us. We have to work with them in a way in which they play to our style of play. And in the second game, in fact, in both games against Ukraine, we took a little bit off our attacking style and added it to our defending systems. And I felt it helped us so much, because normally we would play right through the units and try to be inventive and creative. And we took some of the stuff off the top of that and put a lot of emphasis, especially in the second game, where we were in this bizarre situation where if we lose 1-0, we go through. So rather than create mixed messages for the players, we spoke about if we win the match, we're through, instead of saying if we lose 1-0, we're through, because that's a very dangerous approach if you look at trying to lose 1-0 or by one goal. So we played the first half without them scoring was our first goal. To restrict their movement and shut down all their spaces in those key areas of the pitch. And I felt we really achieved that. And then in the second half, we upped the game. We started to get more movements to the front. And you could see us gradually taking over the match. And I felt that's what we did.
Have you always been that pragmatic manager who, if the opposition, as it changes, you will willingly adjust your style, or are you a bit more idealistic at times that actually I have a style of play that I want my teams to go out with? And well, clearly with Northern Ireland you have been willing to change. Have you always been like that?
Yeah, because I think it's arrogant to put the team out and say things like, this is the way we play, it doesn't matter how they play, if we play to our strengths we can win. We weren't in a position to do that. If you're playing the Faroe Islands, you can take that attitude and that approach. But our main aim was to nullify areas of the pitch where they were very good. Like Panashenko, for example, is a very good player. With over 60 goals, she scored against us out there. So we had to frustrate her as much as we could. Kravitz is where the source, we had to stop that source coming from Kravitz, and we achieved that. So we took the two main weapons out of their game, and we worked on our goalkeeper a lot, where she comes for crosses, and she did fantastically well. She hadn't a shot to save the whole match, which was testament to the performance of the players.
And I guess, the results showed that it worked, but that late red card as well for the Ukrainian player, that is the video that's gone viral from the match. It was such a cynical foul, probably showed that you got to them mentally as well, that their heads, it seemed, were just gone.
We never give them a second on the ball in the second half. In the first half, we dropped off the game a little bit more, but in the second half, we were right on around them, and they had no space to do anything. They couldn't even hit their long balls. And the work ethic and the work rate of the players helped us to achieve that. But the sending off, it should have been two red cards if there was such a thing.
it's one of the more bizarre fouls I've ever seen, because it did look like she might actually win the ball. But clearly, as you say, mentally just wanted to leave a mark maybe on one of the Northern Ireland players. And listen, you got the win. Obviously, Northern Ireland's in a different position to the Republic at the moment in terms of COVID and vaccinations. Were you able to celebrate?
Yeah, well, between you and me, no, I'm only joking.
We had a small
celebration.
Okay.
And it was very good. The girls were happy and we were happy and the staff were happy. Everybody was in a really, really good mood. The AFA put us on a meal and looked after us very well. So yes, we did have a couple of jars, but not many.
Good man. What was the dressing room like at full time? Because this is an incredible achievement for the players. How were they in the dressing room afterwards?
They were unbelievable. They were so, the tears was tripping them. And the staff the same, they couldn't hold back their emotions because it was such a journey. Like, by the time the Euros finish, it will have been a 3-year league or a 3-year campaign, because that there is, you know, it's incredible what the girls have done, because they were so much the underdogs.
What were your expectations when you took the job? As I mentioned, you've obviously had a very long career and had success in Scotland with Kilmarnock and most recently at Derry City. And as far as I'm aware, you were in the mix for the men's job as well after Michael O'Neill left. What were your expectations? Because it's been thrown out there a lot that the team disbanded. It is 20 years ago at this stage. It's back 16 years, and you've spoken about the conveyor belt that's starting to come through from underage level at Northern Ireland. Did you know a lot about what the women's team could achieve? What were your thoughts when you first got the job?
Well, first thing I had to do was, there was post-trauma in the girls. They were so, they felt traumatized and things weren't right for them. And
in what way?
I had to do so many things about their mental state. I had to help them to start enjoying themselves. I had to give them encouragement. And, you know, I'm not saying all of us, the staff and everybody got mucked in and did a really good job in the psychology of the team. And I felt that was the starting block. And we didn't set big targets. I put two words up in the big board when we went into our first meeting. And I put up trust was one word, and the other word was integrity. And I explained to them at that meeting that if we can keep those two, because you can't have one, because if you don't have trust, you lose the integrity. If you don't have integrity, you lose the trust. So we put that up and we worked off that as our template. That was our template and our war cry in everything we did. So there was no grey areas. It just created an environment where there was no grey areas, no areas of doubt, no areas where I don't trust her, I don't trust him. That eliminated the whole thing. So what it created was a team dynamic. So from the team dynamic, we worked in the chemistry of it. And anybody that comes in new, I tell them this story, that they have to fall into that psyche. And that's what we are. That's our emblem. That's how we advance as people. And, you know, to see them laughing and having fun and screaming their heads off with satisfaction and pleasure and all of those things that you want in life, they brought it all out. They just broke down at the end of the game, and I thought it was a really momentous moment for them and for me myself as well to really enjoy that period after the game, to feel that we have achieved something big. And it was something big.
Yeah, it sure is something big. It's very rare that a manager goes into a job when a team is flying, when a team in a dressing room is full of confidence, because usually managers end up leving when a club is at a low ebb. So when you look at the dressing room you went into and compare it to dressing rooms you've gone into over the last three decades, and you're talking about the mentality there and the mental state, were you surprised by how low the confidence was, how many issues there were within that dressing room?
Yeah, I'd heard stories. I didn't believe them, but when I got there, I certainly believed them. There was a lot of bad stories, and I had to try and provoke some positivity and get them to, you know, I had to really come across to the players. I knew I had to, as a strong personality, and I realized that they needed me. I knew that I was good for them. But that's very singular, and it's very big-headed of me to say that. But I'm just giving you what my deep thoughts were at that time. I'm no better than anybody else. But in the same token, I had that perception that there was issues, and I attacked them straight away, head on, individual meetings, the whole lot. And I think they knew that they've got something to aim for, and they knew the pathway that I was trying to create for them. They knew it very, very quickly.
What were the issues?
I can't say too much because it comes back to haunt you, but there was issues. Nothing to cloak and dagger, but more oppression and things like that, where the girls weren't given space to do things. They weren't allowed to do so many things. It was the COVID before the COVID. In June 19, there was restrictions. And we had to take the shackles off them, basically.
Yeah. Because most of them are amateur players, and quite a few of them have day jobs, how different is it then in comparison to managing at Derry or managing at Kilmarnock? And you do have to let them go. You don't have total control of the players. They have to live their life because, quite literally, it is their livelihood outside of football.
Very much so. But I had previous experience in 2000, from 2000 to 2008. I took Northern Ireland under 17s, and in those 8 years, the last six of them, we qualified for the elite stage. So I had experience with international periods of in, out, you know, you're not working week to week. And we were the smallest nation ever to get to at that time, the Euros. We got to the finals. The men's, the boys, under 17s. And I used a lot of stuff that I used then, building the confidence. And they're playing against players like Fabregas, and, you know, the top players in the world were playing in those finals. There was only seven teams qualified. Northern Ireland were one of them. So I felt big about that, and I learned so much from that experience, because it's the only time that they've qualified as well. But you're working with a new batch each year, and I felt that was a great opportunity for me, and it helped me when I went to the women's. I felt
it is one of the difficulties you now face is that it's a long wait until the finals themselves, and I think Northern Ireland are going in as the first country. They'll be the only debutants at the tournament in England next year. There's World Cup qualifiers. I think the draw is at the end of this month, and they're going to take place September, October, November. There's a lot of games, whereas generally you qualify and that is the group that you bring to the finals because it's a short gap. There's a possibility here that, unfortunately for a lot of these players, they may not get to the finals. That you, I'm sure, will be hoping that over the next year or so that a lot of more players emerge.
Yeah, of course. I'm working with the 19s. That's another thing that I do. I bring the 19s into the senior team to train with us so that they're getting education. They're playing against, along with the top players in the country, so their game is kicking on. So I'm preparing for the future as well. I've got the under-19 girls in around us all every session.
What are you looking for then at the finals? Do you want the big draw? Do you want England? I know you played them recently in a friendly, which gave you a good insight into where they are, a chance against the hosts. What are you hoping for?
Well, I looked at the pots today, and in pot number one, there's England, France, Germany, and Holland. So those four will be in four different groups, and one of them will be in our group. And then pot two is Sweden and those other top nations. And then in our pot, we're the lowest seed, so we're in pot four. So our three opponents will be from pot one, two, and three, which is the upper echelons. So, you know, the task is enormous.
Mm.
And I bet you if you looked at the betting on it now, it would definitely be in treble figures. So it's going to be a big ask to qualify from the group stages. But hey, why not? It's over a year away and we've got a lot of time to work with them. And we will try our best to be our best.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot to look forward to. It is, before we let you go, it is a family affair as well. Your son, Dean, who people remember as a player around the League of Ireland and who was with you at Kilmarnock as well, is involved. I think he's going on his own managerial journey as well, just starting out right now with Dungannon. What advice are you passing on to him?
He knows the game inside out. He's a very, very modern coach. And he's doing the same as I did, because when I went in at the start at Carrick Rangers in 1992, I played out from the back then, and we built through the units. We made mistakes, we lost matches, and then we came good after we won the County Antrim Shield after the first year. And he's taken over Dungannon. He's doing the same. He's taken a beating at the early stages. But the players are learning. I can see a mirror image of what I did. And he's up for, he plays very developmental and the players are getting better. So over the period, he'll do well.
He was happy, was he, despite that young idealism, to go with the more pragmatic approach against Ukraine?
Yeah, he's happy with it. He sets up good, he gives them good education on it and what their requirements are.
Yeah. Well, listen, it all worked out very nicely indeed, Kenny, and you got a lot to look forward to over the next 15 months or so ahead of that, starting with the draw as well. Hopefully, it's a favourable draw, but no matter who you get, there's going to be some really enjoyable games in there as well. Congratulations again, Kenny. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power. Fake crowd noise. The Emirates never sounded so good.
Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.